Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 251. It's Monday, March 18th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's start up with some good news. Looking globally, childhood deaths at record low, but progress is precarious, says UN. The number of children worldwide who died before age 5 reached a record low in 2022, the United Nations said in a report published last Tuesday. As for the first time, fewer than 5 million died. According to the estimate, 4.9 million children died before their fifth birthday in 2022, a 51% decrease since the year 2000. And a 62% drop since the year 1990, according to the report, which still warns such progress is precarious and unequal. Behind these numbers lies the stories of midwives and skilled health personnel helping mothers safely deliver their newborns, vaccinating children against deadly diseases, and making home visits to support families, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said. But this is a precarious achievement, the report warned. Progress is at risk of stagnation or reversal unless efforts are taken to neutralize the numerous threats to newborn and child health survival. Researchers pointed to already worrying signs, saying that reduction in under 5 deaths has slowed at the global level and notably in the sub-Saharan African region. In total, 162 million children under the age of 5 have died since the year 2000, 72 million of whom perished in the first month of life, as complications related to birth are among the main causes of early childhood mortality. Between the ages of 1 month and 5 years, respiratory infections, malaria, and diarrhea become the main killers, ailments which are all preventable, the report points out. In order to reach the UN's goal of reducing under 5 deaths to 25 per 1,000 births by 2030, 59 countries will need urgent investment in children's health. And without adequate funding, 64 countries will miss the goal of limiting first month deaths to 12 per 1,000 births. These are not just numbers on a page. They represent real lives cut short, the report said. The numbers also reveal glaring inequalities across the world, as the sub-Saharan Africa region accounted for half of all deaths of children under age 5 in 2022. A baby born in countries with high early childhood mortality, such as Chad, Nigeria, or Somalia, are 80 times more likely to die before their fifth birthday than a baby born in countries with low childhood mortality rates, such as Finland, Japan, and Singapore. Where a child is born should not dictate whether they live or die, said the WHO head. Okay, well, that classifies as good news, especially compared to this next story, which is decidedly bad news. This in the United Nations. Imminent famine in northern Gaza is entirely man-made disaster. Act now to prevent the unthinkable. Palestinians in Gaza are enduring horrifying levels of hunger and suffering, said the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres outside the Security Council in New York. This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded by the Integrated Food Security Classification System, anywhere, anytime. I want to read that again. This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded, anywhere, anytime. This is an entirely man-made disaster, and the report makes clear that it can be halted, he warned, saying this showed the need for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. I call on the Israeli authorities to ensure complete and unfettered access for humanitarian goods throughout Gaza and for the international community to fully support our humanitarian efforts. We must act now to prevent the unthinkable, the unacceptable, and the unjustifiable. So I've been kind of annoyed in recent weeks because you hear over and over about imminent famine. So I actually looked at the latest report for Gaza and seeing what the definitions of famine. I won't bother you with the technical classifications, but let's just put it this way. The UN says that 4 out of every 5 person in the world that is extremely hungry is in Gaza. That's 80% of the people that are extremely hungry in the world. And that is particularly stunning since only less than 1 out of every 3,000 people live in Gaza worldwide. So 1/3,000th of the people and 80% of those that are extremely hungry. So comparing to what we've seen with the terrible deaths level of deaths that have happened so far with the bombing and armed conflict, which has been on the order of about 200 per day due to direct violence, either being shot, being bombed, being crushed by falling buildings and the like. But if we move to famine level, which is seen to be imminent, we're talking about if that's Gaza-wide with a population of about 2.4 million people, that could easily be over 700 deaths per day. That's not from violence. That's just from starvation. So if we're talking about direct violence killing on the order of 200 per day in the months that we've had so far since the October 7th attacks, which triggered the massive Israeli assault into Gaza, we could see triple or quadruple that easily just from starvation deaths. And this has been my fear the whole time from a public health perspective, is people talk about the deaths from direct violence. But when war at its worst, this is an acute problem, but in the long term, when you talk about the destruction of entire society, the long-term deaths that roll out over months and years is huge as well. But this is a massively acute problem where you're talking about many multiples of the number of people are killed by starvation as compared to even direct violence in warfare. We must act now to prevent the unthinkable, the unacceptable, and the unjustifiable. Okay, well, sticking to the same topic of food insecurity, but moving back to first world problems, this from Health Day. Increases in food insecurity seen in U.S. families with older adults. From 1999 to 2003, compared to 2015 to 2019, there was an increase in food insecurity among U.S. families with older adults, according to a study published in JAMA Health Forum. The researchers observed an increase in food insecurity among U.S. families with older adults from 13% to 23% in 1999 to 2003, compared to the 2015 to 2019 period. There was more than a doubling seen in the rates of recurring food insecurity from 6% to 13%, and more than a tripling in the rates of chronic food insecurity from 2% to over 6%. High food insecurity rates persisted among Black and Hispanic families, those with lower socioeconomic status, and those participating in the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP program, across both of these time periods. So over the last couple decades, we've seen that food insecurity is actually increasing, particularly those households with older adults. And while that's tragic enough, living in the most affluent country in the planet's history, we also can't seem to get our health care system in order. This from Health Payer Intelligence. Few physicians participate in both Medicaid and Marketplace plans. So why is that important? Less than 3 in 10 primary care physicians participating in Medicaid also participated in an average Marketplace network, raising concerns about continuity of care for beneficiaries disenrolled from Medicaid. States resumed Medicaid eligibility determinations in April of last year before the COVID-19 public health emergency ended. As of March of this year, 17.7 million beneficiaries have been disenrolled from Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. Beneficiaries who lose Medicaid coverage may be eligible for premium subsidies on the Affordable Care Act, ACA, Marketplace. However, care continuity may not be so simple for these individuals if there is not a lot of overlap between physicians accepting Medicaid and Marketplace plans. With minimal overlap of physicians in both Medicaid and local Marketplace plans, beneficiaries disenrolled from Medicare may face barriers when trying to find a Marketplace network that includes their primary care physician. So we did see actually a record rise in the number of people on the ACA Marketplace, and part of that is because people were kicked off Medicaid. So the issue here as far as continuity of care is that because there's little overlap, if you get kicked off Medicaid, you have a great likelihood of actually not having your regular providers on your new whatever in-network is. So this is probably one of the best arguments, a good example of a great argument for why we should have a healthcare system that's universal. Everybody in and nobody out. There is no out of network. Everybody is in the same network. That's the advantage of a national health program. Single payer is the best, least complicated, and best for those who are being served by it. And more on that front is some Kaiser Family Health news. How your in-network health coverage can vanish before you know it. One of the most unfair aspects of medical insurance in a system that often seems designed for frustration is this. Patients can change insurance only during the end-of-year enrollment periods or at the time of, quote, qualifying life events, such as divorce or job change. But insurers' contracts with doctors, hospitals, and pharmaceutical companies, or other arbiters, so-called pharmacy benefit managers, can change abruptly at any time. That is particularly galling for patients because whether obtaining insurance through an employer or buying it on the marketplace, they generally choose a policy based on whether it covers their desired doctors or hospital or an expensive drug they need. Turns out that particular coverage could evaporate at any time during the policy term. Consumers are put at risk, according to a recent report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. In the escalating warfare over pricing between big, consolidated hospital systems and ever bigger insurers in a cutthroat market, such contract disputes are increasing rapidly. The Becker's Hospital Review website cites 21 insurer-provider standoffs in the third quarter of 2023 alone, a 91% increase over the same period the year before. Many insurers say they will continue paying for a period after the contract ends, often 60 to 90 days, or to complete a, quote, episode of care for a pregnancy in particular. But with, say, cancer, would that mean one round of chemotherapy or the full course of treatment, which could last for many years? Is it continuity of coverage if a patient must change oncologists midstream or if a patient has to leave an effective therapist? It is bad for patients' health and sanity that the perceived promises of care in their insurance plans can suddenly disappear mid-year. And regulators can do something about that. Obligate providers and insurers to maintain their contracts with one another for the full term of patients' policies, so no patients are left in the lurch.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And next up, a story how pharmaceutical companies are not serving humanity well. This from Medical Express. Study finds U.S. drug approvals from 2010 to 2019 align with U.S. but not global burden of disease. Drug approvals in the United States between 2010 and 2019 were aligned with the U.S. but not global burden of disease, and the increasing number of expedited drug approvals could make the gap worse, according to study in the British Medical Journal Open. The study also demonstrates that drugs indicated for conditions with the greatest burden of disease were likely to be approved through FDA's expedited approval programs that reduce the timeline and cost of drug development, thus making it relatively more expensive to develop these products. This research showed that the majority of drug approvals were indicated for conditions in the highest quarter of U.S. disease burden and years of life loss. In contrast, only a quarter of these approvals were indicated for conditions in the highest quarter of global disease burdens or years of healthy life loss with disability or ill health. There was no alignment between the indications of approved drugs in either U.S. or global disability. Since the U.S. burden of disease represents less than 4% of the global disease burden, these data indicate that there's little alignment between the drugs being developed by the global pharmaceutical industry and the health needs of global human populations, which basically just means the rich countries are developing it more for their needs, which doesn't match well with most of the world. You call it a third world, but it's more like the two-thirds world. Okay, next up, some new data on drug use among high school students. This from Stat News. Delta-8 THC use reported by 11% of high school seniors. In the last year, an estimated 11% of high school seniors have used Delta-8 THC, according to a new report published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Delta-8 THC is a quasi-legal psychoactive version of cannabis, which has skyrocketed in popularity after a loophole found in a 2018 federal law allowed it to be sold nationwide without the same restrictions placed on traditional marijuana. While legal marijuana is sold only at licensed adults-only dispensaries, Delta-8 products are currently sold online, at gas stations, and smoke shops, and in many states where traditional marijuana is entirely illegal. There's also no federal minimum age to purchase Delta-8 products, basically unregulated. Tobacco vape manufacturers known to be popular with young people, including Puff Bar, are now manufacturing their own Delta-8 THC vapes as well. Delta-8 products are also commonly available in edibles resembling snack foods like Flamin' Hot Cheetos, Gummy Worms, and Pop Rocks. The new data were gathered as part of the 2023 Monitoring the Future survey, which is conducted annually and funded by the National Institute of Health. The survey provides some of the first concrete evidence that Delta-8 products are making their way into the hands of kids. Monitoring the Future did not ask about Delta-8 use in previous years, so first-time data. While 11.4% of the over 2,000 respondents surveyed reported using Delta-8 in the last year, 68% of users reported using the product more than 3 times, and 17% of users reported using the product more than 40 times. So that's 11% overall, but only about 2/3 of them used it more than 3 times. And only a couple percent of the total respondents, total high school seniors, had used the product 40 or more times. The rate of Delta-8 usage among high school seniors still appears to be lower than that of marijuana use overall. Just over 30% of survey respondents reported using traditional marijuana in the last year. Over 90% of Delta-8 users also reported using traditional marijuana. The rapid rise in the popularity of Delta-8 has nonetheless already caught the attention of NIH officials. There's little research on the health effects of Delta-8 compared to traditional marijuana. However, multiple studies have shown that adolescent use of cannabis is associated with impaired cognitive development. The FDA has warned that Delta-8 products may also contain harmful contaminants not found in traditional marijuana because of the process used to create the drug, which typically involves boiling CBD with a solvent like heptane. Smoke that heptane. Well, of course, this is particularly a problem because this particular product, since it has a loophole where it's pretty much available anywhere, not really regulated, it's very easy to get in the hands of young people. And while adults, of course, people of age can choose to do whatever they want, it's not just a personal freedom issue as a public health problem. Most of these drugs have more adverse effects in young people with developing brains. Okay, well, next up a story in kind of a roundabout way, that meat kills. This from Reuters. Despite rising deaths from bacterial infection, meat industry is under little pressure to wean itself off antibiotics. It has been almost 100 years since the discovery of penicillin kickstarted the era of antibiotics, revolutionizing the treatment of infectious diseases and opening the door to many modern medical procedures, including treatment of cancer. But today, infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria are among the leading causes of death for people of all ages. They directly kill 1.2 million people in 2019, more than HIV/AIDS or malaria, according to research published by The Lancet, and has played a role in the deaths of more than 5 million in total. The death toll could spiral to 10 million people per year by 2050, according to a 2016 review on antimicrobial resistance commissioned by the UK government. The WHO lists antimicrobial resistance among the top 10 threats of global health, while the World Bank estimates that antimicrobial resistance could shave $3.4 trillion off the gross domestic product worldwide annually and push 24 million more people into extreme poverty in the next decade. One of the main drivers is the misuse and overuse of antimicrobials. In human healthcare, they are often misused, misprescribed, or sold over the counter without prescription. However, by far the biggest consumers of antibiotics is the meat industry, responsible for 73% of antibiotic use globally. They are used in intensive livestock production to treat and prevent infections and are also added to animal feed to increase growth. In addition, the proportion of the most medically important antibiotics is increasingly going to farmed animals instead of humans, according to an analysis published last September by the National Resources Defense Council and One Health Trust. In 2017, the meat industry purchased 62% of the U.S. supply, but by 2020, that had risen to 69%. In many of the world's richer countries, antibiotic use in animals has been curbed by regulation. For example, in the European Union, the use of antibiotics for growth promotion has been banned in member states since 2006. The legislation banning preventive use of all antibiotics unless prescribed by a vet came into force in 2022. Some livestock sectors within European countries have already achieved significant reductions in antibiotic use, such as Danish pork, and in Italy, where use has been slashed by 96% in chicken and 92% in turkey in just 7 years, starting in 2015. However, data from the European Medicines Agency shows huge differences in farm antibiotic use between European countries, according to the Alliance to Save Our Antibiotics. In Poland and Spain and other livestock sectors in Italy, levels are 10 to 20 times higher per animal than the lowest users. While the practice of using antibiotics as growth promoters for livestock was banned in the United States in 2017, use of antibiotics to prevent disease, whether or not the animals are ill, is still sanctioned, meaning that consumption of the most medically important antibiotics for humans is 3 to 6 times higher in U.S. cattle producers than their European counterparts. Elsewhere in the world, increasing consumption of animal protein in low- and middle-income countries is driving a surge in antibiotic use in livestock. A lot of countries either have very limited restrictions in place or nothing at all. Companies often claim to comply with local regulation, but a lot of robust action is needed before regulation comes into place. So corporate actions become really, really important in the meantime, said Emma Berntman, Senior Engagement Specialist, an investor network that focuses on investment risk in livestock production. This investor network is planning to reboot a previous campaign to lobby fast food companies to improve their policies on antibiotic use. The original push in 2016 through 2019 saw all 20 restaurants it targeted develop either a formal policy or begin the process of developing one. However, since then, they have ended their engagement with the companies and efforts by the restaurants have faltered. It wants them to disclose sufficiently strong policies, develop antibiotic policies to cover all key proteins, and provide evidence of implementation through target setting and auditing. So far, they've signed up 71 investors. This is a similar number to its previous campaign, but they are much larger players, with some $15 trillion in assets under management compared with the previous $5 trillion. Investors are not prioritizing antibiotic use in meat production, according to ShareAction. The UK-based charity has been tracking shareholder resolutions by 16 of the world's largest asset managers, including BlackRock and Goldman Sachs Asset Management, asking fast food companies to reduce antibiotic use in line with WHO guidelines. In 2023, two resolutions targeting McDonald's were rejected by 81% and 83%, while one asking the same of Hormel Foods was voted down by 94%. ShareAction's research manager, Felix Nagarwala, believes that the low number of resolutions on the issue, just three out of some 250 it assessed, as well as a lack of support for those tabled, demonstrates that antimicrobial resistance sits far behind climate change and diversity for investors. Good practice on antibiotic use should follow the WHO's guidelines, which do not allow the use of antibiotics for growth promotion, for which there is no alternative for human medicine, nor for preventative routine use of disease. Should also cover all locations from which it sources and cover franchises as well as company-managed stores. In addition, targets should be time-bound. These policies need to demonstrate that they've actually had an impact. So McDonald's was an example of that. They were lauded as making a lot of progress, but when it came close and these ill-defined timelines, as time went on, they backtracked when action was actually required rather than just policy development. And I'll remind you, it's been projected that antimicrobial resistance and the diseases that run rampant when you can't treat them could actually be the leading cause of death by 2050 worldwide.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, next up, the more we dig into the health and environmental effects of plastics, the worse it gets. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Plastics chemicals are more numerable and less regulated than previously thought. Fewer than 6% of more than 16,000 chemicals associated with plastic production are regulated worldwide, according to a new report from PlastChem. PlastChem is a project funded by the Norwegian Research Council that identifies and seeks to address potential harm from plastics and polymers. The report builds on growing evidence that suggests plastic production, use, and waste is flooding humans and Earth with hazardous or potentially hazardous compounds, and that regulation to protect us from these compounds is not keeping up. The report found 16,325 chemicals related to plastic production, whether used intentionally or as a byproduct of the plastic life cycle. They found 6,276 chemicals have been studied with data available in the public domain. Fewer than 6% of these chemicals are regulated. Very few of these chemicals are regulated on a global scale, said Martin Wagner, first author of the report and a member of the PlastChem project team. There are simply too many out there. The report suggested increasing industry and government transparency of chemicals, new regulations that target specific chemical groups similar in structure to known hazardous chemicals such as PFAS, bisphenols, and phthalates, since production outpaces the time needed to study each individual chemical, and inclusion of their research into the UN Global Plastics Treaty draft. It's easy to manage pollution you can see, but pollution you can't, you need to get really clear data. Of course, the first core of the three core functions of public health is assessment. You need to know what's going on before you can respond to it. And of course, when it comes to the petrochemical industry, the U.S. is subsidizing law-breaking petrochemical facilities. This from the Environmental Health Network, as reported from Inside Climate News. Gulf Coast sees petrochemical surge, raising environmental and economic concerns. A new report highlights the rapid expansion of petrochemical facilities along the Gulf Coast, drawing billions in tax breaks despite pollution concerns. The Environmental Integrity Project found significant growth in plastics production facilities, with Texas leading in new developments and receiving substantial state tax abatements. These facilities have repeatedly violated pollution permits, yet their financial incentives remain unscathed. Public funds diverted to these corporations could have supported local education and public services, raising questions about the true cost of these investments. A key quote from the report, "I think if companies can obey the law, they shouldn't be rewarded with taxpayer money," said Alexandra Shakevich, research manager at the Environmental Integrity Project. Why this matters? A 2020 University of Texas study estimated that proposed petrochemical facilities could emit as much greenhouse gas as 131 coal-fired power plants by 2030, making up over 8% of U.S. emissions. Local residents face increased risk of exposure to air pollution, raising alarms among environmentalists and health advocates about the direction of energy infrastructure development and its implication for public health and safety. Furthermore, communities of color are more likely to live at the fence line of chemical facilities, increasing their exposure to fossil fuel and petrochemical pollution. Yeah, can we at least not subsidize it? You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, another environmental story that does have a little bit of good news buried in it. This from Medical Express. New study quantifies health impacts from oil and gas flaring in the U.S. A new study led by researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the Institute for Environment, Boston University School of Public Health, and the Environmental Defense Fund finds that pollution from oil and gas venting and flaring results in $7.4 billion in health damages, more than 700 premature deaths, and 73,000 asthma exacerbations among children each year. Researchers also conclude that emissions are underreported and controlling emissions is not only profitable for operators, but also can significantly improve public health in surrounding communities. So there's the rub, which is actually a good news in the sense that it's an opportunity should we avail ourselves of it, is that actually these businesses, by reducing flaring, which of course is just burning up their product, can actually improve profitability of the operators. So it can be a double win. It's good for business and it's good for public health. Don't you love that? Hopefully that's some low-hanging fruit that we can pick. But of course, sometimes a very profitable petrochemical and energy industry overlooks even those smaller profits. It's just they just don't have the time for it. So oftentimes regulation is needed. And this next story from ProPublica gets at one of those. New EPA rule to cut ethylene oxide emissions from sterilization facilities. The new rule comes after a 2021 investigation by ProPublica and the Texas Tribune, which revealed the EPA's years-long failure to inform communities of the risks they face from cancer-causing ethylene oxide emissions. The U.S. EPA last Thursday issued a rule to slash toxic emissions from commercial sterilization facilities that have posed an increased lifetime cancer risk to residents who live near them. These facilities release fumes of ethylene oxide, labeled by the agency as, quote, one of the most potent cancer-causing chemicals. Ethylene oxide, a flammable, colorless gas, is used to sanitize medical and dental equipment to reduce the risk of infection and fumigate certain food products. Long-term exposure to ethylene oxide can cause irritation of the eyes, skin, nose, and throat, as well as damage to the brain and reproductive system, including cancer. The new rule will place stricter limits on how much ethylene oxide commercial sterilizers can release into the outside air, eventually eliminating about 90% of emissions of the gas nationwide, according to the EPA. An analysis by the environmental group Union of Concerned Scientists found that about 13 million people live near these facilities, and these emissions pose a disproportionate risk to poor and minority communities. In Texas, residents say a plant in Laredo, Midwest Sterilization Corporation, has contributed to the city's elevated rates of cancer. Facilities would be required to install pollution control equipment, conduct continuous emissions monitoring, and file quarterly reports to the EPA. Reducing cancer in communities exposed to toxic air pollution has been a prime focus of the Biden administration's environmental agenda. The new rule will address emissions at nearly 90 commercial sterilization facilities, including some in Texas that are owned and operated by approximately 50 companies. Prior regulations on commercial sterilizers that use ethylene oxide did not account for the EPA's latest research. In 2016, the agency concluded that ethylene oxide was 30 times more carcinogenic for adults than previously thought, and 50 times more carcinogenic for those who are exposed since birth. A 2021 investigation by ProPublica and the Texas Tribune revealed the EPA's years-long failure to inform communities, including Laredo, a city of more than 250,000 on the Texas-Mexico border, of the risks they face from the cancer-causing chemical. The Texas Department of State Health Services conducted two assessments in 2022, examining cancer rates from 2006 to 2019, and found a higher rate of acute lymphocytic leukemia, breast cancer, and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, compared with cancer rates elsewhere in the state. In 2022, Earth Justice sued the EPA on behalf of environment and community groups, including the Rio Grande International Study Center, for not updating the rules in nearly a decade and leaving communities unaware of the risks. The lawsuit is still going on. Following news reports, the EPA published proposed requirements last year to reduce ethylene oxide at these medical sterilizers. The agency conducted public hearings, webinars, and meetings to hear from communities and their health concerns. It also published an analysis of the industry's self-reported emissions data that showed about a quarter of the nearly 100 commercial sterilizers, including the one in Laredo, were exposing nearby residents to unacceptable cancer risks from ethylene oxide. The agency also published risk maps and other information online for each of the high-risk facilities. The rules go into effect shortly after they are published in the Federal Register. Facilities will have 2 years to install monitoring and pollution controls and an additional 180 days to demonstrate compliance. If facilities need more time, they can petition states and the EPA for an extension. In the past, the state's environmental regulator, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, has disagreed with the EPA's science assessment of ethylene oxide's dangers to health and the environment. The Texas Commission launched its own review of the chemical in 2020, which ruled that it was significantly less toxic than a federal agency had found. The Texas Commission attempted to enact a new standard that would allow plants to emit more of the toxic chemical, but the EPA rejected it in 2022. Richard Reichter, a spokesperson for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, said the agency will implement the new standard and facilities will be required to comply with the new rule. Well, thanks for obeying the law, Texas. Okay, next up, a story for a warming world, as Metro Phoenix last year has confirmed 645 heat-associated deaths. Public health officials in Arizona's most populous county reported they confirmed a staggering 645 heat-associated deaths last year, more than 50% higher than in 2022, and another consecutive annual record in arid Metro Phoenix. The numbers in the preliminary report by the Maricopa County Department of Public Health alarmed officials in America's hottest big metro, raising concerns about how to better protect vulnerable groups, such as homeless people and older adults, from the blistering summer heat. The report said two-thirds of the county's heat-related deaths in 2023 were people 50 years or older, and 71% were on days the National Weather Service issued an excessive heat warning. Deaths from heat are a major public health issue within our community, and it's going to take support from every level to improve the situation, said Dr. Rebecca Sunshine, the County Public Health Department's medical director. With a coordinated countywide strategy, nearly every one of these deaths can be prevented. The heat-associated deaths confirmed in 2023 represented a huge jump from 2022, when there were 425 such deaths. There were 339 heat-associated deaths confirmed in the previous year, 2021. In recognition of the growing problem of heat-associated deaths, Arizona's Department of Public Health last week named a physician as the first statewide heat officer in the nation to address extreme environmental heat. Dr. Eugene LaVar was appointed to the state role under Governor Katie Hobbs' Extreme Heat Preparedness Plan. Yep, one more preparedness plan for emergencies. Climate change, global warming. And Phoenix continues to lead the country as a big, hot, arid metro in the U.S. Okay, next up, a fascinating story about how lead poisoning is not necessarily only a problem for children. This from the Commonwealth Beacon. lead exposure may have played a role in Maine shootings. Shortly before Halloween, Robert Card, a grenade and firearm instructor, walked into Just-in-Time Recreation armed with a semi-automatic rifle, opened fire, and plunged the local community in Lewiston, Maine into chaos and uncertainty for days. While the community mourned, researchers at Boston University presented a possible cause. The shooter had CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, from persistent low-level blasts experienced during the time of the range. However, this theory overlooks a more compelling exposure with comparable risks, identical symptoms, and a clear link to violence: lead. Symptoms of acute lead exposure run the gamut of cognitive problems. Exposures have been linked to feeling confused, more prone to anger and hostility, and issues with thinking straight. It's been known to significantly impair judgment, impulse control, and critical thinking. Many exposed individuals report feeling anxious and depressed. Similarly, individuals suffering from CTE experience confusion, mood swings, paranoia, and on occasion increase hostility and violence. Boston University researchers eventually determined Carr did not have CTE, but did have symptoms consistent with traumatic brain injuries, a precursor to CTE. So, where does lead fit into this open and shut case, so-called open and shut case, and how does it relate to the Lewiston shooter? To start with, lead has left an indelible mark on the world. As a durable metal, it's been used in paint, batteries, gasoline, and jet fuel. A well-regarded theory has linked global violence to lead, with substantial reductions after the phase-out of leaded gasoline. This is otherwise known as the lead violence hypothesis. And Card was a great risk for exposure. As an active-duty reservist, his role was petroleum supply specialist. This means he may have come into close contact with lead-containing fuel, that is, jet fuel, which is still leaded. This is an incredible exposure source for adults and possibly impacted his daily functioning. Even more concerning, he spent a considerable amount of time at shooting ranges and grenade courts, exposing him to persistent firearm use. Firearm use is amongst the most underappreciated sources of lead in the United States, as shooters use lead ammunition and primers almost exclusively. When a gun is fired, that lead dust explodes into the air. This is a major risk factor for shooters who inhale the dust, exposing them directly. Similarly troubling is when it settles on their clothes and personal effects, which may then travel with the shooter, continually exposing them or their loved ones. In fact, my team recently published a paper indicating that household firearm use may be one of the strongest associated factors in cases of elevated child blood lead levels across the United States. Prior to this discovery, we had found this relationship consistent at the city, town, and state level, alongside evidence of its association with suicide. To be sure, not everyone exposed to lead will become a mass shooter. There are a host of reasons why the shooter did what he did, and exposure to firearms, lead, and his potential traumatic brain injuries are not the sole causes. However, the undeniable links between lead exposure, firearm use, and violent injury are concerning, and we should be considering chronic lead exposure, which we can easily detect via portable bone scans and blood tests in these instances, along with CTE. Moreover, it's of critical importance that individuals who use firearms regularly ensure that they take every precaution available to avoid lead exposure. Make sure to change your clothes immediately after use, especially before going into a dwelling or vehicle. Wash these clothes separately through the washer, and make sure to run the washer again afterwards to clean it. Limit the opportunities for this dust to impact your children by restricting cleaning to certain locations. And take the setting of your shooting seriously. If you are indoors, make sure it is well ventilated. Given that lead can linger indefinitely in the environment, it's of critical importance that communities ensure safe use and that this is prioritized. Yes, lead poisoning is a problem, and not just for children. Adults can have a myriad of problems, one of them being violence and behavioral disorders. Okay, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 22 bonus articles this week. First up, metabolic syndrome increases the risk of all types of cancer. So this is a little bit of expansion. We've known that obesity, which is often present and is one of the conditions that can lead to the classification of a metabolic syndrome, that this increases cancer risk, but this expands it and gets at the fact that this larger metabolic syndrome, which includes things like blood lipid problems, blood sugar problems, and of course obesity, all increase the risk of cancer. Bonus article 2, salty foods are making people sick, in part by poisoning their microbiomes. So it's not too surprising, and most people know that salt is actually used as a preservative. It's kind of an antimicrobial, and of course it has an effect like that in our microbiome, which is a bunch of microbes. And of course, salt has a whole bunch of effects on our physiology and health, and this is a good article that covers a whole range of those. Of course, the most interesting might be the fact that it affects our microbiomes. Bonus article 3, too much of a food thing. A century of change in how we eat. This is a great little read that gets at how we live in a completely different world. So really processed foods, grocery stores, all of that really started about a century ago. It's hard to imagine a world without a supermarket now. And since like 97-98% of the food that's in a supermarket is in fact highly processed food, be completely unrecognizable. And salt, of course, being one of the big three of most dangerous food additives, along with added fat and sugar, leads to a lot of the health problems that we have. So our food system is sick. Bonus article 4, wildfire smoke warnings need to be issued sooner with focus on how to prepare. So once you're in the middle of a crisis, the wildfire smoke has reached peak conditions, we're pretty good at recognizing that's a problem. Of course, walking outside would probably do much the same for many people. But of course, the real public health issue is trying to get warnings out earlier and try to educate people about what they can do. Close up the house so you don't have as much outdoor air getting inside. You can get air purifiers, that type of thing. And bonus article 5 is a related one about air quality. How low humidity could be a boon for viruses. Study finds excess ventilation may counteract public health interventions. So there's two things that have become really kind of popular and in the fore of our consciousness brought about by COVID is about air exchanges, about switching the air out so you can move the viruses, infectious diseases out of the air, and that would protect us. But of course, when we do that, you tend to lower the humidity. If you bring in outside air that has a low relative humidity, warm it up and it has very low humidity, this actually allows viruses to survive and thrive in that condition. So having a decent humidity in the house is an antiviral, and of course it's also good for our mucous membranes, which is our first line of defense for our immune system. And I personally get super dried out in the winter and like just a decent humidity, just because it's like hard to sleep and it's annoying to have your nose all dried up. So we have to balance these two things. Having ventilation can sometimes be helpful, but keeping the humidity up is also important. Bonus article 6. U.S. measles milestone, 60 cases so far in 2024, and that's more than all of 2023. So we're raring to go. This is kind of the canary in the coal mine, looking at these rather large number of outbreaks. None have been too big that have really taken off, you know, maybe 10 or so. But the fact that we're getting some transmission and we're getting seeded oftentimes from somebody who's traveled outside the country, it shows the fact that we are very much connected to the common fate of a global community. And as measles is becoming more and more common elsewhere in the world, as we travel around the world, we bring back those cases. And we've had pockets of poor vaccination in the U.S. Those outbreaks can continue and become little epidemics themselves. Okay, bonus article 7, very interesting story. Gangsters, money, and murder. How Chinese organized crime is dominating America's illegal marijuana market. So this is fascinating because it gets at the fact that decriminalization of drugs can be a good thing, but you do have to have some regulations around it. And this is where basically there's nothing like it. This is a case study in Oklahoma. And you got actually Chinese mobsters coming in. And because it's easy to grow it there, you can get, organized crime can just grow it really easy there and just move it out of state. They're not supposed to do it, but it's really basically unenforceable. So decriminalization drugs good, but you actually have to have a regulatory environment to keep the worst elements out. Bonus article 8, permitless open carry laws may lead to more firearm related suicides. We know that access to firearms increases suicides. This is just more evidence reaffirming that. Bonus article 9, HIV is no longer a death sentence, but states still have laws targeting people who live with it, becoming yet another tool to criminalize Black people, LGBTQ plus people, and sex workers. Now, this is also another one when a lot of regulations get on the books. They may not be actively enforced, perhaps as they were originally intended, but they never get taken off the books and can become a way to criminalize people and disproportionately enforce it on disenfranchised folks. Bonus article 10, last mile solutions shown to increase vaccination coverage in poor countries. So this means basically having a lot of assistance in getting the vaccines, that last mile or two into the arms of people who need it can really increase vaccination coverage. And also you can piggyback on those traveling healthcare workers to do other healthcare interventions. So reaching out particularly in rural areas can be a big boost to health in those areas and can be an important infrastructure for those countries and regions. Bonus article 11, study finds most restaurants and bars still serving alcohol to intoxicated patrons. So this is illegal in almost every state, except I think Florida and Nevada, but like 80%, this was a regional study, so it's not necessarily representative, but like 80% of the people in this study, 80% of the restaurants and bars continue to serve alcohol to obviously intoxicated patrons. Bonus article 12, Pentagon tries to dodge PFAS lawsuits by claiming immunity over a product it helped invent. Yeah, how convenient. It's good to be the government sometimes. Bonus article 13, forget Oppenheimer. Nuclear power is having its moment in Washington. So D.C., the big power players are kind of sweet on nuclear power now. I would say my whole life I've been an anti-nuclear power and nuclear weapon activist. And this seems to me like a really, really foolish attempt. Calling nuclear power green, I think, is a real stretch. So there's absolutely no technical solution to the storage of toxic waste that will last, outlive us and our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren's times 20, you know, tens of thousands of years and sometimes even more than that, as long as we can even think into the future. And we can barely think usually a year or a decade or maybe a century. With climate change is starting to change our thinking around that. Okay, bonus article 14, the obscene energy demands of AI. How can the world reach net zero if it keeps inventing new ways to consume energy? So we know that Bitcoin is a big energy consumer. AI is a big energy consumer, and that is going to be something that we could see these type of uses take like 10% of our total energy use. So the idea that an information, you know, computer age is somehow saving a lot of energy, because it's not like industrial manufacturing, it still takes a lot of energy. And of course, as we're desperately trying to reach net zero, this is going the other direction. Need to take that into account. Bonus article 15, using X, formerly Twitter, has a negative impact on well-being. And the quote from the article, we couldn't find any positive effects on well-being. There you go. Bonus article 16, 2 or more hours of daily screen time tied to lower well-being in preschoolers. So Twitter's not good for adults. Screen time's not good for preschoolers. And another one on the mental health front, bonus article 17, boys are disappearing from mental health care as signs of depression go undetected, as boys' depressive symptoms are often irritability or anger or aggression. And one for the women, bonus article 18, Menstrual health literacy is alarmingly low, and what you don't know can harm you. So this was an interesting review of medical textbooks and how it was very inaccurate, did not include, you know, the realities on the ground of what women experience, and was very poor scientific quality. Bonus article 19. When copay assistance backfires in patients, another healthcare nightmare where you're actually getting help with expensive drugs and it might actually kick in more copays up front and deductibles that have to be met. Bonus article 20. Concerns grow over quality of care as investor groups buy not-for-profit nursing homes. So when investor groups who are investing to get money, it's very different than investing in people and care for actually elderly. Bonus article 21. Lawmakers want to help California be happy with its newest select committee on happiness. It's a very interesting approach. We often live in a very reductionist, narrow society where we focus on the small things and, you know, see the trees and miss the forest. But this committee is going to be taking a bird's eye view, hopefully the bird of happiness, to actually look at is our public policy actually producing a happier population. And last but not least, 22, paying attention to sensations can help reset the mind and improve mental health. So this is a very good article that really covers the research about how, you know, paying to both mental sensations and bodily sensations connects us. We live in such a disconnected society, kind of a virtual world, and by connecting with the actual world, our own bodies and stream of sensations can actually reset the mind and improve your mental health. You can read any of these articles and all that I've previously reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-